Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon, and I suppose we should probably deal with names right off, because of course you have a given name which I'd ask you to give us, but you're also well known by some other handle. And then why don't you put that on the record first, your given name?
Well, my given name is Clarence Allen Johnson, and that's where the company name C.A. Johnson Electric came from, the C.A. And when I was 6 years old and a paper boy, because my parents were immigrants from Sweden, for some reason, I got called Swede, and it stuck right through public school, high school, and right up to the current time.
And that's how I've come to know you as well. I'd ask you what your given name was this afternoon. Could you put on the record as well where you were born and the date of your birth, and then we'll get into the interview?
I was born on July the 9th in the General Hospital, and we at that time we lived on Macker Avenue. Mm-hmm.
General Hospital here in Port Arthur.
Correct.
Right. Well, the questionnaire that we're working from is oriented towards people who have actually worked in the grain industry, the movement of grain and so on and so forth. Perhaps what I should ask you is how you became an electrician and then an electrical contractor, and if you could sketch something of your life, and then we'll work towards how that related to your to the grain trade, what kind of work you did there.
Well, when I came from Kern River, Claude Garton School in Kern River, I went to Port Arthur Technical High School. And in grade 10, I decided I wanted to major in electricity. I kind of enjoyed the trade, and that's how it came to pass. When I graduated in 1952, in June, I went to work for Eric Peterson of Peterson Electric, and I spent 7 years there as an apprentice for four and as a journeyman for three. And then I decided I would try it on my own, and I wrote my master's license and achieved it. And 7 years to the day almost, I started my own business.
And this would have been then in 19?
That would have been 1959.
1959.
June 1959.
In the midst of a bit of an economic slowdown at the time, or did that apply here at the Lakehead?
Well, I started out with just doing houses and having no working capital, having saved up $800, and nobody knew me as a contractor. I went from every time somebody dug a hole, I went over and asked them if I could bid. Some people said, I don't know you, forget it. Others said, by all means. And I started out like that, and within a couple of years, I had about four people working, and then gas hit Thunder Bay.
Now, well, that's quite a story, too, I guess.
When gas hit Thunder Bay, gas is the electrical competitor, but it was my best friend, because they would go up like College Street and go up the back lane, and there'd be maybe 10 houses on each side of the lane, and maybe five or six on each side would probably take gas and throw out their coal furnaces, oil burners, whatever they had. And I think we had as high as five people wiring gas furnaces and doing as many as 50 and 55 a day.
Well, this is natural gas, of
natural
course,
gas,
where the pipeline came through from the west.
Yeah, and they're running them down the back lanes.
Right. That must have been quite a little period of reorganization of things, very definitely in back lanes, a lot of reorganization of things very briefly, but wow, lot of scrap, a lot of old furnaces and whatnot.
Right, and I was very fortunate because we wound up doing all Sears work, we had all Eaton's work, we had Keenan Sheet Metal, we had McEwen Oil, and we had Supercraft Heating, we had just about every sheet metal outfit that installed the units. We almost did all of them in Thunder Bay. I won't say all, but I bet we did 60-65%.
It sounds as if you just vaulted over the other contractors in town and became the biggest contractor through this?
I don't know. I just had connections. I just seemed to mix with the guys that were in the industry and got to know them personally and gave them good service. And those were the days when you didn't even make out a bill. You made out a bill if you'd say, like, 10 Dacre Street, and the bill would be $12 to wire the furnace. There'd be no itemized hours, no itemized material. It was a flat rate. Some you took a bit of a beating on, others you did all right, some you did exceptionally well. And then every year, of course, they went up a dollar or two as time went by and inflation took over.
So this was all residential work, and was that pretty well the business for a time?
Well, that was the business for probably the first 5-6 years, and then we kind of got into apartments and old age homes. Well, we did quite a few old age homes,
still residential,
large old age homes.
Still residential in its way. But,
right.
But it's still kind of semi-commercial,
I guess. And then we slowly graduated into going into commercial, and we got into lots of schools and new schools, running, remodeling old schools, building, doing new service stations, considerable out of town work from Fort Frances, Atacocan, Kenora, Red Lake, Wawa, even Sudbury.
Was yours the largest electrical contracting firm in town?
No, I think there was, at the time, there was about four of us that were more or less did everything in Thunder Bay, with the exception of very small work where other organizations or other contractors had maybe two or three men working for them.
Who were your competitors, the other firms?
At that time, it would have been Strawn Aiken still Eric Peterson, who I had learned my trade through, and Mahon Electric, and myself.
So you were the...
Oh, and Sylvester Electric was then in business then, too.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The only firms left from those now are... Is Mahon Electric still...
No, they're out of it.
No.
No, the only one, Strawn Aiken's gone, Johnson Electric's gone, Sylvester's gone.
You've retired, or are you still?
I retired, no, we're right out of it. Yeah. Other than I still have the corporation, which only does my own work
for
the rental buildings.
Right. When did you first do something that related to the grain trade then?
The grain trade I started. I guess back in, a couple of notes here, I started back, my first relationship to the grain trade was when Pool 4B blew up.
In
Kern River.
Right,
19. I think that was the Sasweet Pool, and it blew up in Kern River, and there's about approximately 85 people, of which the majority were from Kern River, that got killed in that explosion.
Right. This is, what, the late 60s?
This was in about 46, I was very young. Now,
First experience of, right, yeah. It's August 45.
I'm still in high school.
Right, it blew up the day, sort of within 24 hours of the first atomic bomb being dropped.
I
beat in the papers for it, I can tell you that's what happened. August 1945.
That I didn't realize, okay.
Okay, so you say 85.
It was around 45, 46.
August 45.
Okay, and I got hired on because I was in the electrical in high school at grade 10. I got hired on by Mahon Electric to be a stock boy down at where they were rebuilding the elevator,
right,
at Pool 4B.
And how long were you employed there at the time?
I was there about 3 months over the summer holidays.
Right. So this was the first experience of, the elevator wasn't working, obviously, after
It was...
How badly was it damaged?
This was when I started there, was probably a year, year and a half after, before they got underway and started rebuilding.
Okay, so it could be 46 then. It blew up in 45.
You're right. So this would have been around 46, 47.
Which is your memory then, the summer of 46 perhaps?
Yeah, Commonwealth Construction was building it, and Mahon Electric was a subcontractor that were doing the wiring for while a lot of it was brand new, and some that they were able to salvage of the old building.
Now, do you have a memory of what was involved in the reconstruction, whether changes were made from what it had been like before the explosion?
Well, I was pretty young, but of course they would have been modernizing with all the latest and latest in technology and everything for handling the grain.
And dust control? Did you have a
sense? Dust control, considerable dust control, because that was what caused the original explosion that killed all those fellows.
So I might mention that we interviewed V.B. Cook, and he was an engineering student at this time and wrote on dust and the danger of dust.
Right.
Of course, the U.S. and around the world, it's in mines, first of all. But elevators, of course, produce similar dust problems. So he had a paper from the University of Toronto engineering faculty. You are as a high school student, of course, coming to grips with the, or helping those
right.
who were trying to deal with the problem. So what more do you remember from the experience?
Well, the day it blew up was amazing because I was coming down on I was about 14 and I was coming down the hill on a bicycle and I just hit the top of the Kern River Hill there where the Jolly Roger Hotel used to be when it blew up. So I got a first-hand sight of this huge bellow of smoke and fire and everything. And I took my bicycle and I bicycled right down there. Of course, we could only get so close and the firemen arrived and...
I'm trying to remember, positioned myself from there, across the trees that are there between the street and Current River and the dam and so on. You
right.
could be looking through the trees or over them to where the thing had blown up.
Well, I was right on top of the hill, so you had a pretty good view.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was quite a sight.
Yeah. Quite a noise, I expect.
And I was a paper boy at that time, or earlier, so I knew all those fellows that, I knew most of them that got killed in that thing. I knew them and I knew their families because I grew up in Kern River. And it was certainly a tremendous tragedy.
Yes, yes, it certainly was. So the deaths ran to what?
I think it was in the 80s.
Okay.
80, 85 people, I think, died.
Mm-hmm. Did this whole experience have any impact on your own choice of occupation later?
Not really. It was amazing because I wound up becoming a stock boy down there for Man Electric on that same elevator about 2 years after. 2 years after it blew up,
mm-hmm.
and I spent the summer there working for them. And of course, I was liking the trade, and I definitely decided to stay with it, and major.
So you said grade 10.
Bill Astle for a grade teacher in grade 10.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
1932, you'd be 18 in 1950 then. So this is about age 15, 16. This is very close to the time that you made your decision to pursue the trade.
Right, right. And it helped.
I dare say it would have. So from that experience then, probably summer of 47, did you have any experience or any contact with the grain trade, other than the dust in the air, of course, which continued through these years? Any experience with the grain trade?
Well, directly? we did a fair amount of work in the elevators.
When would that have begun?
That would have probably been about in the late 60s, early 70s. We did some major work in some of the elevators at inner city, and I think we worked in about three of them. But we did, I'm trying to recall the exact name, but I think we're in Pool 7.
Right.
We ran lots of huge cables and just put a new distribution system in.
Okay, let's take one of those elevators if it's Pool 7 then. What kind of work were you contracted to do? What were they do? What was the end result going to be?
We were mostly running, at that time, we were mostly running brand new electrical feeders to all the explosion-proof panels and everything.
So this was in support of panels going in
right.
that would not produce sparks, I guess, that or not be,
correct.
Be explosion-proof.
And then on a couple of the other elevators, we were doing a lot of smaller contracts. They need $50,000 to $100,000 of the work done. That was too much for their own people to handle. We got called a fair amount to do that type mm-hmm. of work.
So we've had interviews with three men, one of whom, someone like yourself, as a young fellow, was involved in the late 40s and kind of coming to grips with the dust control problem, I think, for the first time. And then we interviewed someone else who did work in support of this kind of work, maybe 20 years later or something. Then we interviewed a third person who's been involved much more recently as a sheet metal worker with the change of machinery and so on and so forth. And so if this is taking place around 1970, did you have a sense then that there was a upgrading of dust control going on, that pollution control was more of a factor for the companies?
Well, I think at that time, after they'd had that major explosion, I guess they were getting a little tougher on the grain industry and sitting on top of them for the safety of the men and staff that worked there. And regulations got tougher and tougher to get dust control. So there was a certain amount of fair-sized jobs done in the elevator, which entailed mainly electrical.
Yes. I see. Yeah, the machinery would be operated by electric motors, yeah. I suppose. And the
right.
Were you faced with particular kinds of codes or regulations on how to put it, install this?
Well, there's a large section in the code book, and you have to get very familiar with it, and your staff had to get very familiar with it. And of course, then you had electrical inspections, which I think they took extra care to inspect those very carefully, so that, you know, if anything did happen, that somebody wasn't brought to task because they didn't do their job properly, whether it was the contractor, the hydro inspector, or just who. So things were done pretty good at that time.
This was detailed bidding by now, I suppose, contracts that have some length and so on and so forth.
Well, I've been out of it 14 years now, so I don't know.
Well, I think back to those years.
And then after that, of course, then the green industry started to slip in, I guess, what was that, in the 90s, early 90s?
I think
90s?
As early as the mid-80s, things began to slow down.
Yeah, slowed down considerably.
But there was a 15-year period, maybe, from 68 or 69 through 83 or 84, mm-hmm. where things were pretty lively. How many men were you employing? Mostly male, I suppose.
All in told, I guess we got up to a maximum of about 55 for 1 or 2 years, but normally we had a regular staff that ran anywhere from about 22, 24 to about 35.
Right. These were including your office staff as well, where I suppose.
Well, you'd have to add about another 5 for that.
Women were there, but the people out in your electricians were all male, I suppose.
No, we had a couple females.
Did you?
Yeah. It didn't work out for the best, but we tried, and there was certain chauvinism out there, no two ways about it, and she could handle herself as well as anybody amongst the men, right down to the language. But I think it just got a little rough, and out of town was a problem. Now your costs would double if you went to send a girl out of town, because now you got to rent 2 rooms instead of one, and then you're going to have troubles with wives worrying about their husbands and husbands worrying about their wife if she's married. This one happened to be single, so we're probably one of the first, if not the first, to hire a female apprentice.
How long did she last then? Did she finish the apprenticeship?
No, I guess she was with us about, I don't think much more than about a year. Mm-hmm. I know she was working when we did Murillo School. She was working out there.
Oh, yes.
And when they did the Centennial Building for Tom Jones over at Fort William there on Victoria Avenue, she was working there as well.
Mm-hmm. Did she become an electrician?
Oh, she was competent. She was very good.
I mean, did she continue in the trade, I guess is what I'm asking.
I kind of lost track, so I really don't know.
Right. Would this have been, what, in the early 80s or late 70s? So I get the sense from some other interviews we've done that it was then that maybe the federal government was encouraging employment equity. We began calling it that in the 80s.
Yeah, I think it was the mid-80s, around the mid-80s, I believe.
Right, okay. So when you took on Pool 7, let's go back to that, how much of your workforce would be in there?
Well, we'd have probably about 6. Mm-hmm. 6, 7, that's about all.
And they were there for weeks. Now this would be what, in the winter time when the work is slowed down?
That would have been winter and summer. We were there, we had a fairly, we had a, at that time we had about a $500,000 job, so We were there for, I don't know, we were there for probably 8 or 9 months.
I see. And is it, how difficult is it to do the work while the elevator is operating?
Well, the only trouble we had, a lot of it, it was very high. We were working in some places 70, 80, 90 feet in the air. And that created a bit of a problem, trying to work at that height and building scaffolds and everything.
I can well imagine.
And handling huge cables, like heavy, heavy cables.
Yes. How big were the cables?
Oh, we had up to, I guess, four conductor, 250 MCM, which is like that.
Right. What you're just indicating is something I'm wanting to say 4 inches across, but what should we say?
No,
something
about,
like 10 centimeters.
2.5, 3 inch diameter, yeah. Cables, and down to inch and a quarter.
Of course. But that's quite a cable to be pulling up.
And then we had to put racks up, and they had to be strapped every 8 or 9 feet. They had to be strapped across the bottom of the upper part of the elevator.
Not everyone's happy working up there, I don't suppose.
Well, you had a mixture of men, and some men fear height, others it doesn't bother them at all, you know. And, of course, you take the fellas that if they didn't want to work on heights, we had fellas that didn't mind it at all.
Yeah.
And we did that on a lot of other projects as well, up in the ore dock on Fort William and different jobs like that, that they had to work at considerable height. And a lot of them, I won't say they're fearless, but a lot of them, the height doesn't bother them.
They did seem almost fearless when they were up there.
You learn that early in the trade, that you got to work on height.
you yourself are quite happy.
Well, I worked on the ore dock when I was with Peterson, and I remember they had a trolley line, kind of a trolley line for the ore cars, and we had to put poles up. The poles weren't very high. They were only about 30 feet, but they were right on the edge of the dock on both sides, and we had a string wire between across the dock every 150 feet or 180 feet. And then they were supported on the outside by like 6x6s, and we had to climb the poles. And then when you went to tie the wires in, you had to have a belt around you, of course, and spurs, and you were about 60 or about 80 feet or 70 feet above the ore dock trestle, which was about 180 or 200 feet in the air. So now you're suspended with your back to the water. So you now you're not only 40, 50 feet up, but you're also another 180, 200 feet to the water. So I remember kind of shaking that time.
The first time particularly.
Yes.
Remember going up on a barred roof for the first time, it was under construction, and coffee breaks seemed to happen very soon after I got up there, and everyone went down to the ground again. But you begin to get used to it.
And I remember they brought out four huge poles from BC for up Paquette Road. They had some kind of a huge aerial there in a diamond shape of four poles that were about about 120, 140 feet high, the big BC firs they brought in, and had to climb those. And you couldn't get started with the belt. You had to put up an extension ladder and climb the extension ladder against the pole before you could throw the belt around.
Because the tree was
Throw the belt and start climbing. And you had to put the belt around because it was so big you couldn't get enough grip with your fingers around the pole. And then until you got up a few feet, and then it was okay. You could undo the belt and then climb with your hands.
Sure. The joy of being a contractor, the owner of the firm, is you have other people doing this, I expect.
Well, I had that for both. I was active both as a contractor and a worker for about, I guess, about 6 years, 5-6 years. And then I had got right away from the tools. It just got too large. Yeah. I had a bad problem with growth. We grew too fast. Financially, it was a problem, and growth-wise, it was a problem. We just multiplied too quick. I think we moved 7 times in about 16 years.
This is your own office?
My office and shop.
Sure. I see. And you had to be the brains of the outfit, or did you have an office manager, for example, that was good on the paperwork?
No, you're looking at him.
I suspected as much.
I was the office manager and estimator, but then eventually I had two full-time estimators, and well, one was a full-time estimator and one was part-time estimator and superintendent. And then I was on the overall.
Sure. So this was your three-person operation?
No, then I had two girls.
Two girls
and a receptionist and then a bookkeeper.
And the bookkeepers, of course, are worth their weight in gold if they're any good, aren't they? They really
absolutely
keep control of everything.
Yeah. Is it a bigger firm? I had the same girl for about, 27 years or something. Yeah. She worked there. Very good.
Mm-hmm. The receptionist, of course, knows what's going on as well, for that matter.
They changed a little bit, but my bookkeeper, she was there a long time.
Yeah. 27 years, that if it were, began in 65, that would make it 92.
That was that, I guess that was a history of, I was in business from 59 till, and I was in business 36 years.
Mm-hmm. So for the larger part of that period, the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The electricians working for you, much of a muchness, so to speak, they were similar skills, or would you differentiate amongst them in terms of different specialties?
I probably had one of the best crews in town, because we could probably handle, we had about 8 superintendents, so we could handle a job like we did the Valhalla, and we could handle that, schools, and we did considerable work out of town. Sometimes in the mornings, we'd have 4 to 5 trucks leaving to go to town Monday morning at about 6 a.m., 6:30 a.m., in different directions.
What would be the, or let's say, let's take a school, what would the organization of your workforce at the school involve? A superintendent, I gather.
A superintendent. Working superintendent.
Sure.
They really never involved that many. Usually 2 to 3, even for a large school, because it took quite a while. They took a long time to build. Mm-hmm. And maybe near the end, when it came to finishing, you had to put a couple more in there to finish it off. But normally, usually you had about a 2-man or 3-man crew. That was about it.
And of course, they're working away room by room or whatever, however you work, divide the work up. It's the same kind of work in every case, I suppose. And tying it into the control panels and so on.
It goes up, and it only goes up so fast, and you can keep up with it.
Yes. Yeah. Was industrial work different from that, or was it just larger in scale?
We didn't do a lot of industrial work.
Say Pool 7, for example. How many, did you say earlier, how many?
We had about 6 there.
About 6. So it isn't really really out of proportion more. It's
industrial,
well, it's twice as many.
Well, industrial is, industrial mostly were existing buildings, mm-hmm. not too much new. Yeah. It's the biggest industrial job we did was Ryko Chemical, when they were over by Canada Car there.
Right, this is in support of the paper industry, I guess.
That was probably the biggest cost-plus job we ever had for almost $1 million that they just gave us.
And the whole, they were building from the ground up.
And they were building from the ground up.
Yeah. And for the rest, it would be upgrading, revamping, or whatever. Are there additional things to be said about working in connection with the grain trade? Other elevators, or were there some that stand out in your mind in terms of being interesting?
Well, there was, I forget the name of the small elevator that was on the waterfront, because we did a lot of Heinbecker.
Oh, yes.
Parrish
and Heinbecker.
Parrish and Heinbecker. We did a lot of work there over the years. They pretty well used us for many years almost exclusively.
And so why would they need a lot of electrical work done?
I don't know. I don't think they had much of a staff of their own. They only had, I'm only guessing, but they only had maybe a couple of electricians. So if it got beyond any regular maintenance or become a major item in maintenance, they called people in rather than have them on staff, and half the time not having any work for them.
Mm-hmm.
So in those instances, we were getting called in to do the extra work.
So if you're doing a lot of work at this one relatively small elevator over the years, why was electrical work needing to be done? Was it changes in code or changes in regulation?
No, they brought in new cyclones and things from the west, you know, that they were making out west, and I think even here they started making them. And
that's dust control, I think.
Yeah, mostly to do with dust control and progressive new equipment and changing conveyor belts and conveyor systems that had to be wired, the motors and stop-start stations for conveyor systems. So they were upgrading constantly.
Yeah.
All the elevators were consistently upgrading.
There was a time when the elevators were powered by, let's say, a central steam engine and ropes running the equipment. And the electrical motors, of course, could change that completely. Were you involved in any of the conversions?
I remember big belts. Like, I remember going to Hillcrest and being in a machine shop, and they had the lathes run by belts instead of a direct drive like they would have on a modern lathe. And I remember down there that there were a lot of things that were operated by big, wide, 3-4-inch wide belts.
Right.
That
this is at the school that you're talking about, is it?
This was at Hillcrest for the machine shop.
Right.
But they had on a much larger scale. They had it in the elevator, and it was running a lot of different things that they were running right off a pulley of a motor.
Sure.
And then had these huge belts that were, I don't know, 4 or 5 inches in diameter, and some of them 20-25 feet long, and then of course doubled up.
Right. And we've seen ropes.
And a lot of that stuff changed over the years. They eliminated it, and they got direct drives or gear drives.
Yes. Oh, and you had a query. Oh, okay. Well, I'll let you, when you wanted, you put the question then.
Thanks, Ernie. Sweet, I just wanted to get back to that point in your time when you were a young man and with your paper route and riding the bike down towards the shore in August of 1945. And I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more depth of what you experienced and what happened, maybe that period of time between your seeing the explosion and your arriving on the scene.
Well, I guess the saddest time was I was a paper boy and I was delivering to a lot of those fellows that got killed in that explosion, and I knew their families and I knew their kids, and it was a very sad time for Kern River, and it took Kern River a while, I don't know, several years, I guess, if ever, to get over that tragedy, because there were so many from Kern River that got killed in that explosion. And or maimed, you know, I guess there was a few that got maimed and injured and probably injured for life, but it really affected the whole population of Kern River very, very much so.
What do you remember about the explosion itself? Were you just kind of caught totally unawares, or was there any sort of inkling that something was happening?
I just heard a large boom, and I saw that cloud when I was on my bike, so I stopped right. I was just coming to the crest of the hill, and I just stopped and observed, and then all of a sudden flames start shooting out, and then it went down. Of course, it was concrete all over the place, and before you know it, there was, I don't know, dozens of fire trucks there and ambulances and everything.
You were one of the first people on the scene?
I was one of the first ones to the site.
And so it probably was quite chaotic for the rest of the day there.
Yeah, they set up a line right away to keep everybody back, and just, I guess they were feared there might be a further explosion, but that had done so much damage that just blew out the walls and there was cement all over.
Rescue operation was going on at that time, or were they trying to get the men out at that time? Or?
Well, we couldn't get very close, and there was still a lot of, it was early, and I don't think they could even get close to that fire. It was such a burning inferno, and it took a while before they could even get near it to rescue anybody.
you were talking about Current River and the impact on it, and I was on a, I was in, at the cemetery in Port Arthur a while back, and one of the tombstones that was pointed out was a young boy had been killed in that explosion. He was 16 years old. So, and there were a number of, you know, as you say, a number of people who knew, were very close neighbors of yours at that time as well.
Yeah, well, my dad worked at that time at the Thunder Bay paper mill down the highway, and we knew a lot of people in Current River. Well, I'd grown up there since we moved there when I was about six, and now I'm 14, so I've been there most of my life up to that time, and both my parents knew a lot of people, and I certainly knew a lot more than they did because I delivered papers there.
Days of funerals, I guess.
Pardon?
Days of funerals from the various churches in Kern River.
It was a very sad situation.
What actually, where had the explosion actually taken place? In one of the silos?
I would think in the storage bins. You know, that I'm not sure, but it's the bins that blew out.
Yeah,
and I guess once the bin blows out, and if there's a spark or fire and it blows to the next bin, I guess several bins blew out, and a lot of them were full of grain or half full of grain, and the grain spilled out onto the ground.
Now these bins, would these have been the concrete?
So yeah, they were huge. They were probably 20-25 feet in diameter. And just like a huge cylinder that
High. That's what I'm calling silos, and some of
those the silos.
Some of those had blown apart.
Oh, you know, they just blew the walls right up.
So that's an awful lot of energy in the explosion, isn't it, to do that? Because we've witnessed the attempts to knock Pool 6 down, and that took quite a while. Yeah. That concrete is not easy to knock down, and I don't suppose Pool 4 was much less strong as far as that's concerned, but.
When I was going to high school, I worked down there for over the Christmas holidays and that for to relieve fellas for holidays, and I did what they call banjoing, which was the old. No, I'm sorry, that wasn't that elevator. This was an older elevator that had flat bottoms. Most of the newer elevators all were like an ice cream cone on the bottom, so they just opened a chute there, and the grain went onto a belt.
Yes.
But in the original elevators, they had a flat bottom. So there was a big hole in the center of the floor, and that's where the grain went. Well, when they emptied the elevator, they wanted to get that grain out of there so it didn't get mixed with the new grain coming in. So they had what they called banjoing, which was a piece of metal about 5 feet long and about 8 inches high with a handle on each end, and you threw it, two people handle it, and you threw it out and then pull the grain. It went right through the grain like a scissors, and then you pull the grain to the hole, and you got paid kind of piecework there. You went down and did one of those in an evening, and your evening was over. So you had to climb down with a harness on you and somebody feeding a rope down slowly in case you slipped going down the wrong ladder, which in a lot of places the fastenings to the silo had let go. So you went down this ladder, and this comes heights again. If you don't like height, you don't do that, because this was about 100, 120 feet in the air where you climbed down, and there was one light bulb hanging. And that was the other thing. That was just an ordinary light bulb, like on an extension cord. There was nothing explosion-proof. It was just an extension cord hanging down with a 200-watt light bulb on the end of it, and that lit the silo on the bottom. And they just lowered it to maybe 20 feet above you, and then you could see, because there was no lights in there whatsoever.
Yeah, you need to. So two of you would be lowered down.
So the two of us would crawl down that, climb down that ladder one at a time, and they'd feed that rope, and you'd have that harness on, and you get down until you went up to your waist in grain, and then they also pulled. Of course lowered the banjo, they called it. They lowered that down on a rope, and then they pulled it up again at the end of the day, and they'd come around every half hour or so and check on you to see if, and holler down at you to check on if everything was okay.
So was this a job for high school students
then? This was a job that I had, I think it was over the Christmas holidays, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just once?
That was one season. Other season I worked for delivering mail at Christmas for the post office.
Sure.
I've worked since I was about six.
Right. And, so this was a second experience of the grain trade,
yeah,
early on.
And probably, I just noticed in the paper last night, they must be looking for, the Chronicle must be looking for, I don't know, 50 or 60 paper boys. Mm-hmm. It was in the paper last night, different routes and what they pay. And I was just amazed because I guess people today, whether they don't care if their children work or just what, but that is a learning experience and possibly had a lot to do with me going into business. That you learn to collect money, you learn that you can't trust everybody and they disappear on collection day or they move out and it left you with 2 weeks and you had to go good for it to the News Chronicle at that time, and you still had to pay up even though you didn't collect the money. And it was a very learning experience, and I carried papers for about 3 years anyway, and I had probably the biggest route in Kern River of anybody. I had about 120 papers, and I'd had to take a streetcar down to the Chronicle, which was right where the Marina Tower office building is now.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it was right there, and then I had to get my papers, and according to how you handed in your collect is how they distributed the papers to the paper boys. So if you got your collect in early, you get your papers early. If you got it in late and people paid you, or if you were fortunate enough to have enough money in cash that you could pay before you got paid, you got your papers earlier, you know. Then take a streetcar and go back to Hodder Avenue, get off at the Hodder Avenue Hotel, and then I went up as far as the Water Tower, and then I went over as far as Granville Avenue and Dewey Avenue, and I covered right from where the rec center is there, right through to Black Bay Road and right up Leslie Avenue to the Water Tower where the old ski club used to be, and right up on top of the hill even, yeah, before you get to the expressway.
Well, that sounds like most of Kern River.
Yeah, well, the upper part.
Yeah.
I used to get out of school at 4 o'clock, whatever, and I'd get home around 7 in the evening by the time I was finished my paper.
Yeah.
So yeah, my father taught me how to work.
That is a real learning experience, no question
yeah,
about
it. And it's too bad a lot of the kids are missing it today, and because I think it has a lot to do with becoming an entrepreneur. If you get into that type of work early, where you're responsible rather than employed by someone else.
Al Petroni had the exact same story, and basically got him going by having to sell papers, and he had a number, and he said that was a great learning experience.
Yeah.
They talk about the social media these days. The media, the newspaper, was quite the social thing
in
its day.
You only had radio and newspaper and radio. That was about it.
But in terms of getting to know people, learning things, mm-hmm, and so on, interacting with your community,
exactly.
I dare say, would be a great experience. Your electricians were members of the Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, I suppose. IBEW.
I was for about 7 years. Well, you don't become an A member, what they classify as an A member, until you become a journeyman electrician. So you became a B member, which is an apprentice, and you paid a lesser rate of dues per month until you become a journeyman, and then you paid the going rate.
Right. Do you remain a member even when you're a contractor?
No.
No.
No. No. No. The day I start contracting, the day I departed as a union member.
Yes. Did your...
But I was a union contractor.
Sure.
I was a union contractor, but I did not belong to the union.
Yeah, your men were union members.
All my staff belonged to the union.
Right. How were negotiations conducted locally, or was there negotiation?
I was the negotiator for probably 15 years.
For all the electricians,
I negotiated
was
for all of the District of Thunder Bay pretty well. Everything was run out of here, and then when Ontario became, we went into provincial bargaining, and Ontario came under one huge electrical agreement that took in 13 unions. I represented from Manitoba border to White River. And Kapuskasing. I represent that area, and I remember going down for negotiations trying to get 13 unions to agree and make our first agreement as a contractor. And I think I went to Toronto that year 32 times. Mm-hmm. And sat in a hotel till 3, 4 in the morning and negotiated with these guys. And it was tough slugging. That took months. Yeah, and it cost a lot of money in the electrical business.
Was there a work stoppage during the negotiations, or
no. Not to my knowledge. Yeah. No, I think we were all under various agreements. That didn't mean that everybody was the same, but it was negotiated that, you know, when we got a raise, Toronto got a, everybody got a raise together, and there were certain things that were negotiated in there that applied to everybody across the province. And then there were other items that only applied to certain areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose Toronto might have particular requirements, or would the District of Thunder Bay be more likely to have its own special?
Well, concern? We were heavy into room and board because we did a lot of work out of town in the district, and a lot of people down in Toronto, they don't go much farther than Toronto or Niagara Falls. So I recall sitting at that bargaining table one day, and we were bargaining on room and board and everything, and they said, well, we don't know if we want to get involved with room and board. He said, like, there's some of us here in Toronto, we go as far as Niagara Falls. And I remember telling him, and I said, you know, in Northern Ontario, we go that far in a flat tire.
The joy in saying that.
Yeah, I did. I enjoyed saying that. So they kind of shut up and left us alone on room and board.
And you arrived at an agreement on that.
Like Northern Ontario, you know, Toronto area, the greater Toronto area, even will fit in one little wee corner.
Yes. It's a pleasure to remind them of that.
Right.
Would you say that your relations with the workers, or as a contractor with your with the workers,
over the years? I had excellent relations. I had fantastic relations with my staff. My staff were so good that when we had our, when I closed up and we had our 10th, it was actually the 10th year, a couple of my staff phoned me and said, would you mind if we have a C.A. Johnson Electric reunion party? She says, where you're working for, they were working for 6, 7 different outfits, but most of them are managing most of the bigger jobs around Thunder Bay to this day, the superintendents I had, although now some of them are starting to retire. Mm-hmm. But they had invited the wife and I, and they had a big party, and we invited, they looked up numbers for all the people that worked for us, even if they don't work 6 months over the 36 years, if they could track them down, and invited them all. And we had about, I guess we had about 75 or 80 at the party. And
80 workers.
This was workers and wives.
Workers,
yeah, it was a double outfit.
Sure.
And that was 10 years after I retired.
Right.
So I don't think they do that for every employer.
No, I wouldn't think so.
No, unless they had a care. But to this day, I meet them, and they don't hesitate to want to buy me a coffee or something. Say, no, I'll get the coffee. Don't worry about it. I had a terrific staff.
Yeah.
And they were great guys.
Sure. Well, we've let me get to some of these particular questions we've got added in here. If you, as you look back over the work that you did here in the city and in the grain trade, particularly, of course, for our purposes, what would you like people to remember about the work you did over and above the retirement party?
Well, the grain trade, I think I've just about discussed that as much as we did. We weren't huge in the grain trade. We were more into commercial with schools and malls, a lot of out-of-town work. We did a lot of gas stations. We did places like the Valhalla and Thunder Bay Mall and the police station and sure. that type of work.
I suppose
the college,
what we might do,
university.
Conceivably the university, would be to put this in context. The elevators were simply one more opportunity or challenge, whatever it might
right.
be, one more of the kind of work that had to be done.
Well, we did everything that pretty well pertained that needed electrical work, you know.
Yes.
The only thing we didn't get involved with very much over the years was paper mills.
Mm-hmm.
I had a reason for that. The paper mills, and I'm not criticizing, but they always supplied the major equipment, like distribution panels, heavy wiring, and the contractor was left to look after the nuts and bolts and the straps and the connectors and mm-hmm. all the odds and ends, and they bought and paid for the huge cables, and they had them on site when you got there, and that. So the contractor didn't get any of that, and I just found it difficult to be in business and not supply
right.
the material. So of course now your labor rate has to go up considerably.
Sure.
And your labor is your biggest gamble.
Because there's a margin on the
there's
materials.
There's a margin on material and labor.
For you when you're
yeah.
providing it.
But when you work for a mill, you have a much, much larger margin on your labor.
I
because
see.
You're literally supplying very, very little material.
Right. And did they recognize that, I suppose?
Oh, I think they do. And yeah. I guess it's for, they probably have the reason not only for the money, but because sometimes delivery, you know, that they can order this stuff and have it sitting there when they call the contractor in to do the job.
Yes, yeah. Did you work mines at all?
Not
this wasn't
really a little.
Most
we did
of the
a little
period
work.
Intensely. There wasn't a lot of mining in this
yeah,
immediate
we did
area.
A little work, we did a little work down at Hamlo on that. Yeah,
right.
we didn't do a lot in mining.
No, but there's lots of
no.
other work. Right.
And that was kind of... The mines were kind of in a different area, which covered by
yeah.
Sudbury and Sault Ste. Marie.
That's what I was
and
thinking.
And once you get the other side of White River, we don't really have jurisdiction.
No.
But we did some
no.
work in Hamlo
right.
on that at one time.
I mean, the main mine that comes to mind might be Shabandoan, but in our more immediate
yeah.
area. Of course, Atacocca. Well, that's before your time again, the Steep Rockets. So
well, it
wasn't
out
early.
There. I just got married, and we bought a property out there in Shabandoan, and I remember that mine going ahead, but we weren't part
yeah.
of it.
And that was, it was an Inco operation, was it?
Inco, yeah.
Yeah, so probably the Sudbury
right.
people were organizing all of
right.
that, so on and so forth. Is there anything about the work that you did that would interest people or surprise them, you know, in terms of John Q. Public out there listening to this, or?
Well, we were very diversified. We were probably one of the most diversified shops in Thunder Bay that we did just about everything, you know, mm-hmm. whether it was schools, malls, where out-of-town work, considerable out-of-town work, down in Fort Francis and
mm-hmm.
and out to Kenora and up to Red, like I said earlier, up to Red Lake and as far as, remember we did a Canadian tire store with Tom Jones in Sudbury,
mm-hmm.
and we did a high school in Wawa,
oh, yeah.
and we did considerable work, right. Long Lac, Geraldton, Bell Telephone Buildings, Brewers Retail.
Were there working associations, I mean to say, not in terms of organizations as such, but relationships, I guess that's the word I want, with specific contractors? You mentioned Tom Jones now, for example. Would you have done the electrical work on many Jones projects?
I probably did way back when we were both younger. I probably did, I'm just guessing, 70%, 75% of his work, and I did probably about as much with Gateway,
mm-hmm.
and I did probably half with Sten Lindstrom, and some with Clayton Construction. And yes, you get a name with them, and money is very important, but completion date, when you're on a schedule, you have to be finished on a certain day, especially for a mall or something, because the store's moving in and the furniture's arriving, shelving's arriving.
Sure.
And if you can't schedule to that and you're not ready, it's going to cost somebody a lot of money.
Right.
And there's real penalties. There's big penalties.
Sure. The bids would be separate, would they? Someone would be, Jones would be bidding for the structural work. You'd be bidding quite separately for the electrical? Or?
I would bid to Jones as a subcontractor, and Gateway, and Steadman,
right.
And the rest of them.
Yeah. But you're bidding towards whoever is going to pay for it all, yours as a subcontract. Or were you together in the bid?
Oh, there were jobs we did, like with Gateway, we did the original complex.
Canada Games
Complex. Canada Games Complex. We put that package together, and we did that with Gateway.
There's a combined bid for the contract.
And then we did quite a bit of work like that with Tom Jones,
sure.
As well, and Gateway,
right.
Both.
Yes, big firms. Okay. What are you most proud of, other than the happy employees? What are you most proud of in your years of building
in
the city?
Well, I think one of the things I'm the proudest of, I was in business for 36 years, and we, like I did start small, but we grew quite rapidly, and we got up to where we had up to as high as 55 people and regular staff around 25 on an average. And in all those years, our worst injury was a broken toe. And I thought that was a record to be proud of, and we used to stress to the men to really look after the kids coming out of high school, the apprentices, and we pretty well stuck to hiring electrical majors out of the high schools. We're pretty specific on that. We just didn't hire anybody. I had a great way of interviewing. I would invite kid in and interview him, and I would tell him that, well, we don't have an opening for electrician right now, but I know I've got a friend of mine that has an opening for a plumbing apprentice. Would you be interested in that? And if he said yes, I said, well, goodbye, the interview is over. And then the next one would come in, and he said, no, sir. He says, I want to be an electrician. I said, well, you're my man. You just got yourself a job.
Just focused.
Yeah.
Well, it's electricity is dangerous stuff. And the kids have been killed when they weren't properly trained and so on and so forth. And that's a terrific accident, a terrific safety record that you have to boast about.
Yeah, that was I think so.
Yeah.
And like I said, we really stress safety every Christmas party and everything. I'd go out of my way to thank the journeyman and that for taking care of the apprentices. Because it's the fellows that come out of school and for the first 4 or 5 years that are not familiar with all the hazards on the job, and there are lots of them.
Yeah.
Like electricity, getting electrocuted is one, but that's only one. And that's probably back a ways. There's a lot worse ways to get hurt than with electricity.
Yes, I dare say.
Although
electricity itself could be.
Yeah.
So you never had anyone electrocuted on the job in any way, shape, or.
No. Okay. I probably got as many shocks as anybody.
Yeah.
But you know, some of us, we still, I can test with my fingers. If I test that, I'm going to put two fingers in, the power runs from here to here. It takes the shortest path. So, but I make sure I'm not standing on wet concrete.
Yeah. Yeah, to electrical current going through the body is a very interesting experience.
Oh, you can get that. If you get it in the wrong way. Yeah.
I mean, if I were to waste time here, I was down in the basement one day when we were living in Nelson, working away with, I guess it was probably a jigsaw, and it needed the unplugging on the cord parted a little bit. And I went to join the with the saw blade in my hands, and I guess it dropped through and joined the current, and suddenly I had 60 cycle current going through at least my hand. I still actually you can see, I think that's the little white
spot. Oh, yeah, right
there is where some of the current went into my right finger and so on. And Fortunately, someone came down, because you know, you make a noise when you do this, and my wife came down, or was it our son, and all they have to do is break the current, of course, and it stopped. But we were going to go out that evening, and I decided to stretch out and just relax, because it's a traumatic experience.
I recall, I think it was on Ambrose Street, we're changing over an electrical service, and he's cutting the wires off, and the journeyman up there, I was only about a second year apprentice, and he was cutting it off, and he leaned and he held on to the stack and was absent-minded just for a few seconds, and of course the power goes through here and right through the chest and everything, and all I heard was a big roar, and he was stuck up there, so he was on an extension ladder, so I shook hell out of the ladder, and he come tumbling down and broke a couple of rungs at the bottom, and he was banged up a little bit, but
still
he was
alive.
Okay. Yeah. And I just shook hell out of the ladder, that's all.
That kind of experience teaches you.
Yeah, that was about the closest call we've had. And I got a good shot one time in an attic, you know, hanging on, and it was the metallic cable. And I got it through both hands, but somehow I got off. But the trouble with electricity, of course, if you wrap your hand around it, you can't open it.
That's right, because it just immobilizes the hand.
And that's
right.
The problem. So when you test, you all use the back of your hand. So if you're not sure. And I did that quite a bit, and once in a while I got a little shot, but nothing too bad.
Right. Well, there are some other questions about the international grain trade and so on and so forth, which really aren't relevant to your own experience, I think. Is there anything you'd want to add to what you've had to say about your relationship to the grain trade and the work that your men did and the contracts that you took on?
No, it was interesting to work down there, and I remember being down there a few times, meeting some people coming off the boats, and even sitting down to have a couple, got invited aboard and went in and had a couple of drinks with them while they were in port, and how they loaded the boats and everything. It was a very interesting. The whole trade was very interesting. The grain part was certainly interesting, but in all aspects, electrical and construction in general is very interesting. If I come back for a lifetime, I would probably do it again. I loved it. I loved the challenge. I loved the gambling.
Yeah.
And it is a gamble. I don't go to the casino at all because I did my gambling.
You've had a lifetime of it.
Yeah. You're bidding on jobs, and you're going by how long is it going to take so-and-so to do, how long is it going to take six men to do this job that's going to take a year, and there's a certain gamble to it, and the weather has a lot to do with it, the men themselves have a lot to do with it, the general contractor has a lot to do with it, so you're doing a lot of gambling. You're taking what you might call an educated guess.
Yeah. When you got the estimators, the guys to help you, Chris took some kind of weight off you, and yet you're responsible. You're finding the working capital. You're the one who depends on
the dollar
comes profit.
Back to you. Like we've had good ones and we've had bad ones. You know, we've had years where we've been very, very fortunate and did very, very well, and we've also had years where we'd gone in and lost $150,000, and we've had years that we've gone in and made $250,000. And you just don't know sometimes. I mean, most jobs go along fairly close to what you're allowing, but then the odd one goes the other way, and it doesn't matter how careful you are, you're going to get one of those bad ones once in a while, or the weather's going to affect you. If it's outside, the weather's going to affect you. Your guys go into work, and it starts to pour rain, or it starts to snow, it gets cold, the performance goes way down when it gets cold.
Sure. Yeah, the cold is bound to have a terrible impact on productivity, and rain can too, unless the building's enclosed already or whatever.
Yeah.
Did you have a good relationship with a chartered bank, if I may ask, in terms of?
Yeah, I had good relationships with Scotia Bank and Royal Bank both. Yeah,
right.
Over the years.
Yeah,
yeah, very good. They went out of their way sometimes to help me when I was on the edge, so-called, and over so-called a bit overextended.
It's not a history that is known particularly to people who haven't been in business, but I know from some of my reading in Canadian history, the chartered banks of this country have played a very important role for more than 100 years in backing and in financing the trade and the industry of this country.
And I think, I don't know how much it is now, but I think back then it was that a banker relied a lot on who you were and what you were like and how hard you worked. And I think they realized that things can go up and down. Everything's not going to be always great. You can be on strike for a while with no work and your overhead carries on. Yeah. And you can go through some pretty tough times. You can have a bad job or a couple of bad jobs, but you can also have some good ones. And as long as you played ball with them and treated them fairly, they certainly come back and treated you. I think it had, more so than today, they recognized the person rather than how much money he made or the bottom line. They looked at him when they gave him credit and how much credit they would give him. And the bottom line certainly comes into effect, but I think much more so today than it did then.
Speaking now as a consumer, if you will, rather than a business person, in my relationship to a bank, one of the greatest changes has been the fact that there was a time, and I remember a banker saying to me quietly, this may have been 20, 30 years ago, well, you can't trust the middle class, who can you trust? Writing a signature, which was, again, an assessment of character. I'll be good for it. What's happened with the establishment of personal lines of credit, of course, is that the banks haven't had to have loan officers out there for people, although they've made their assessment of character, I guess, in terms of the amount of credit that you're allowed.
Right.
So you really manage your own indebtedness. Have business people experienced anything similar? Now, this has really happened through the 90s, over the last 15 or 20 years, I guess, this development of personal lines of credit. It's actually happening in the 80s.
Well, if you go into business, you have to give a personal line of credit. There's no way around it, unless you're a very wealthy person and you have a lot of capital to start with. But if you're like the typical entrepreneur that has little or no capital, that you have to personally sign. And I remember, partners. I never did have a partner in the electrical business, but I remember people approaching me and wanting to become a partner, and I would say, okay, we'd sit down and everything would be fine. And I said, now you're going to have to go to the bank, and you're going to sign on the dotted line that you and your spouse are responsible. Oh, I says, well, my wife would never go for that. And I said, If your wife's going to control you, I said, I don't really want you for a partner. I said, that's the way the game works. And if you haven't got enough faith in yourself, and like I have, I said, my spouse had to sign off on everything, and your spouse has to. And I said, if you haven't got enough faith in yourself, you really shouldn't be in business. And that got rid of most anybody that wanted to be a partner.
I take it they weren't bringing money to you.
No.
They just wanted to
share. It's easy if you got a payday every week or every 2 weeks. It's not a big problem. But the toughest thing is to make that tough decision, especially when you have no working capital to speak of, and you've got to make that decision that payday ceases, and you have no money to fall back on to speak of, and you still got a mortgage on a house, and you got a wife, and you've got to make ends meet. And even if she's got a job, she helps, but you've got to try and pay her way. So the first few years, you watch your staff go fishing and enjoying the weekends, and you're in there on Saturday and Sunday doing billing and estimating, and then supervising and running around to see the jobs are getting done properly during the week, and going in at 4 a.m. and doing estimating, and the phone starts ringing at 8:00 and the men come in. And if you're not prepared to do that, don't go into business.
No.
Not without a capital behind you. If you've got lots of capital, it's much easier, but I think it's harder to survive.
An uncle of mine was in housing construction in Winnipeg in the 50s, and my understanding was that the mortgage was in his wife's name, the title to the house. Is that general?
Well, you can, but I guess that's a way to do it. You can do it, but it's up to the bank how deep they're going to dig. I'm sure they want it can be in her name, but she's got to. They call her in to sign, and said that you're entitled to half that home or whatever.
Yeah, and I take it the house was in play too.
It can't be in her name then.
I apologize for delving that far. No. I mean, this is sort of goes except that it is part of the business, I guess. Well, are there any changes, challenges? Owen, would you want
just
to?
Just one more question.
Sure, by all means.
Ernie and I compliment each other here. Character sounds like it's an important aspect of, you know, your own self-worth as well as how you work with other people. But you mentioned your father kind of instilled a work ethic in you. What can you tell us about that?
Well, my parents were both from the old country. They immigrated here in the late 20s.
From Sweden.
And I was brought up in a house that literally didn't know what debt was. And I think other than maybe a mortgage on the house or a loan to pay that down, a car you never had unless it was bought cash. Although my dad did buy two or three new cars, but it wasn't bought unless you had the cash. A TV set wasn't bought unless you had the cash. So I grew up in a house like that. I had a very difficult time going into business and credit. I was so lost that when I went into business, I was paying invoices. I would go into a supplier and get some wire, and I'd come in a couple of days later, and I'd get the bill in the mail, and I'd come in and pay them. So I was issuing maybe one guy like General Electric, or one outfit like General Electric, maybe 10 checks, 15, 20 checks a month. And there was four or five of them. So one day they told me, look, you get what they call a statement at the end of the month. And if you pay that in 10 days, we're quite happy. And as long as it's not too high, we're going to put you on a limit that you can only buy, like, you can buy $3,000 worth of material, and you can't get over that unless you come in and pay for some. You know. But he said, other than that, you don't have, as long as you keep it under this limit, we'll give you 10 or 15 days after the end of the month to pay it. And I said, is that right? Holy smokes. So that's what I did.
Because the fact of the matter is, I'm guessing that each check cost you something at the bank.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Costing them 10 or 15 times the monthly statement.
And additional paperwork.
Of course.
I went through for an electrician, so I didn't take the commercial end of it. So if I had had a little bit of actual business experience instead of learning it the hard way, things would have been a little better too. But it didn't take too long to start learning.
No, you get the picture.
Yeah,
but that's a tough school that your father put you through, or the family experience. Well, kind of probity that just doesn't exist these days, does it?
And when I left Peterson Electric to go on my own, and I had worked for Peterson Electric for 7 years. I worked on Sears when they built that inner city, and I got on loan to Mahon's because Peterson ran out of work, but he kept me on so that when I must have worked over there. I worked over there for over a year at Sears because Peterson was very quiet, but they paid him, I don't know, they paid him an extra dollar or $2 an hour for my time, I guess. It was just like a lease to them. And I was an apprentice then. But he was a terrific employer and trained me well. I just decided to go on my own, and then my dad talked to me and said, like, Mr. Peterson's been very good with you all those years. He loaned you out. You haven't lost a week's work, 2 weeks' work in 7 years. Why are you leaving him? Why are you taking this crazy chance that you don't know if you're going to be bankrupt tomorrow? But they'd gone through the Depression and everything, my parents, and they knew what the Depression was like. And that they kind of frowned on this. I said, well, Dad, it's something I want to try.
Yeah. Whereas you'd come through 52 to 59, then, was it?
52 to 59, yeah.
The construction and whatnot boom that Canada went through that dozen years after the war. Maybe yeah. 58, 59, things weren't so good, but you could still see the future. And the 60s, of course, bore it out, didn't
it? Well, I said it was
natural,
gas.
Yeah,
it was gas that made me. Those 3-4 years in gas, I did very well.
I haven't researched the beginning of the natural gas, and I know there was some scandal about it as well. But when did the natural gas, was it already in prospect when you decided to start your own firm, or did it follow on?
No, I don't think so. I think it was just, it was just starting, I think, because I started my own in June of 59, mm-hmm. and I think it was in 60, 61 that gas, maybe mm-hmm. a couple of years earlier, I'm not sure, that gas started to come in. Well, it took me a little while before I made connections, and all of a sudden I got this, and then I got this, Eaton's, and I got Sears work. Sure. Well, they were the two biggest stores, and then I got all these other different ones, and we really had a routine to go in and do these furnaces just like that, and they were done, you know, in and out, and crazy hours. Go in January and turn the temperature, tell the people to turn the temperature up to 85 in January, and they'd come in and haul that furnace out and put the new one in, and ductwork and everything, had to replace it, put new ductwork and everything, and they'd have about four guys working there, five guys. They'd put it in at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it was ready to wire. We'd be in there, they were just putting in the last parts in, and we'd be in there to get the heat back on, because it was January.
Yeah.
And sometimes till 10:30, 11 at night we'd be working, and come out of there just like we'd been working in a coal bin.
Yeah.
You'd hit the timber there where the wire was strapped on, and the coal dust would just come down like a cloud.
Yeah, oh yeah. Technological change in the heating industry. Yeah, yeah. People have forgotten a lot of that. Yeah.
There were stokers and all that back in those days. Eh?
Where I got my electrical shock was quite close to a coal-burning furnace in Nelson, B.C. that still had the stoker and so on and so forth. Anyway, well, it's been a great pleasure to
Well, thank you. I don't know if I've been of any help.
Oh, you've told us, you've given us a very good account and of many things, including the character of one first-rate businessman. Yeah.
But, I'm limited on the elevators. Like I say, we did, I don't know, we probably did a couple $1 million worth of work in elevators, but that was a small portion. Like, when I started with $800, and 8 years later, we were doing $5 million, you know. And I had saved an $800 working capital.
Yeah.
But, like I said, it was the first 5 years were not fun.
No. Well, and there was, probably that would be 64, there was probably a certain amount of economic uncertainty through those years, nationally and maybe on a continental. That began the early 60s, and as you say here, natural gas really, it was a...
But you were in the type of thing with natural gas that your labor was your biggest item that you had to finance. Your material was limited. If you were to get into doing schools or malls or anything like that, like, you have to have a certain working capital, you know. It was not unusual for us to have $1 million receivables. Quite common to have $1 million or $1.3 million, $1.2 million receivables.
Six digits always becomes seven, becomes very interesting.
So when you got $800, you don't go and do those kind of jobs.
No, unless you've got a banker with a deep pockets.
They say the first million is the toughest one to make.
No, Mr. Peterson was a Swede as well?
No, he's Finn.
Oh, so he's Finn. Yeah. Oh, that'd be one of those great differences.
But he's a great guy. And there's birthday parties, and I see him every once in a while, and we get along great, always have. Yeah. And I can't have greater respect for anybody that I know of than Eric Peterson.
No, he'd be a Finn Swede.
He's his old place is right over here.
Because
he just had his 90, what the heck was it, his 94th birthday, I think, or 95th.
I see.
Yeah.
So being an electrician doesn't kill a guy.
No.
At least a contractor.
No, and he's like me. He was still working. His son-in-law has the telephone, his apartment, the telephone over there at the inner city.
Oh, yeah.
He did that building for them. He wired that building for them.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much again, sir.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for asking me.
That was great.
My pleasure. Thank you.